Hello, I'm Kaya Willoughby, and joining me is Claire White.
Hello.
And this is Dragons, Sexy Robots, and Adventures, a Nerd Manual. We're here to discuss new nerd creations, how they were made, and explore the roots of the characters and the stories. Today we are talking about The Wicked and the Divine. It's a comic book series. It was published in 2014, when the first issue came out. As of now, we're at 22 issues. As of August 2016. And the Volume 3 trade was just published back in February. And who is this written by?
It's written by Kieran Gillen. James McKelvey is the illustrator, and Matt Wilson is the colorist.
And we'll get into this later, but it is a very, very beautiful comic as far as just purely art.
Yeah, it's one of the best things I've visually read in a long time.
Yeah. So to sum up the series, it's about these gods that are reincarnated every 90 years. And this event where these gods are reincarnated is called the Recurrence. And there's 12 of them. They get reincarnated and they have 2 years to live and then they die. And this era's recurrence, the gods have decided to all become pop stars.
I would.
Who wouldn't?
Yeah, if I had 2 years.
So these gods are 12 mostly obscure deities in this comic. Like, there's a few that you'd recognize. Lucifer, I think a lot of people in the West know about.
Who's Lucifer? Just kidding.
Thank you, Claire. So these 12 pop star deities are all based off of kind of real pop stars right now. Like, the way that they're drawn and the way that they act in this book.
Mostly current pop stars.
Mostly current pop stars. Yeah, there's Lucifer is largely based off David Bowie, so he's not that current, but still, like, a figure that we all know and something that we, like, instantly recognize when you see her. It's like, oh, that's the Thin White Duke, David Bowie. So one of the big things in this comic is fandom and, like, the super fans of these deity pop stars. And these deity pop stars, they're on Twitter, they're on Facebook, like, they're very involved in social media, and the kids just flock to them, and it becomes, like, this super fan culture. And that's what I'm going to be talking a lot about in my segment, like, where the first super fans came from. And also the idea of the pop star as this, like, blazing comet that comes in and changes an era and then leaves pretty quickly. Because in this comic, the deities, pop stars, only have 2 years to live before they die. And Claire will be telling us about the writer and the artist.
Yeah, I'll be going into their background, and I'll also talk about what they were trying to evoke with the comic.
Very cool. Can't wait to hear about that. So with me starting with pop stars, I want to kind of trace the roots back to the first pop star who kind of cast a spell over their audience.
It was Bette Midler in Hocus Pocus, right?
Yes, Claire, you hit the nail on the head. It was Bette Midler and Hocus Pocus.
They were really spellbound.
They were. They were going to dance till they died. that was a big plot point in that movie. No, it wasn't Bette Midler and Hocus Pocus, however much you and I both love that movie. It was a little man called Elvis Presley.
Oh, yeah, that little guy.
And he was actually a big man. but yeah, Elvis Presley was kind of the first spellbinding pop star that fans started getting so into
what
that
year?
Riots were happening.
When was that?
This was back in the 50s.
Okay. So he was pre-Beatles.
He was pre-Beatles, yeah. I mean, he made the Beatles possible because he really popularized rock and roll. And that's what makes him so applicable to this comic is because he was the first one with super fans. Now, Elvis was obviously an American rock and roll musician, and he's largely credited with making rock music popular. So, like, the rock music that we have today, you can trace all the way back to Elvis, and he especially made it popular through the 50s and 60s and 70s. And his music started in the mid-50s. It started in 1954 when he got a deal at Sun Records, and he was from a really poor Mississippi family. And he really came to prominence in the 50s, and that's when all hell broke loose.
I feel like it's one of those iconic images, not even image, it's actually like a video of just girls screaming.
Going fainting at the sight
and, like,
of Elvis Presley.
Yeah, and their poodle skirts.
Yeah, yeah. In 1953, after playing a show in Wisconsin, the local archdiocese actually sent a letter to J. Edgar Hoover, and I want to read an excerpt from this letter because it's so funny. And this letter was once again sent by the diocese of that area in Wisconsin. And it is that Presley is a definite danger to the security of the United States. His actions and motions were such as to rouse the sexual passions of teenaged youth. After the show, more than 1,000 teenagers tried to gang into Presley's room at the auditorium. Indications of the harm Presley did just in La Crosse, which is the town in Wisconsin where he played, were the two high school girls whose abdomen and thigh had Presley's autograph. And one of the reasons why this is so cool in regards to Wicked and Divine is one of the first scenes in the comic is the main character, who's this teenage girl, going to see one of these deity pop stars, and just everyone around her, like, fainting in ecstasy.
I know, they're having sexual experiences and just watching.
The guy next to her, she says, has an orgasm and collapses. So that's when I was like, there's some Elvis in here. And Elvis's performance went so far that judges were ordering Elvis to tame his act. A Florida judge said that Elvis can't perform in Florida unless he tames his act and doesn't make it so
less
sensual.
Gyrating?
Less gyrating. And what he did when he would perform there was he would just stick out his one finger and wiggle his one finger. Just kind of in mocking the judge.
Oh my gosh, and the girls went crazy.
The crowds were getting so intense that the National Guard would often have to be called in to help with security. And one of the people who attended one of his concerts says he'd start out with "You Ain't Nothing But a Hound Dog," and they'd just go to pieces. They'd always react the same way. There'd be a riot every time.
Wow. I feel like even with the current pop stars, like, they are huge. And granted, I haven't been to one of these concerts, like a Drake or a Rihanna concert, Beyonce concert. I just feel like you don't need the National Guard for them.
No, it was a whole different animal. When it was something that people had never seen before, that this one musician was like really shaping the times, and what a lot of people were afraid of, he was corrupting the youth, quote unquote.
They're always afraid of that, though.
Devil rock and roll music. And Elvis's first appearance on The Ed Sullivan Show was seen by 82.6% of people who owned a TV, which is a lot. I don't think you've ever seen numbers like that.
No. What would be the closest thing? The Super Bowl?
Yeah, I guess the Super Bowl would probably be your closest thing. Granted, there were less TVs back then, but still, that's a lot of people who own a TV.
Watching Elvis, yeah.
Yeah. And they would also only shoot him from the waist up because they thought that they couldn't show his pelvic thrusts on family TV. You know?
It was just
crazy. And I don't know. Like, to me, reading this comic really reminded me of Elvis. So Elvis died in 1977, but his aesthetic is still huge in the public consciousness. I mean, like, even if you don't know much about Elvis, you know about Elvis impersonators. You know that you can go to Vegas.
You would know who Elvis was if you saw him.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You can go to Vegas and have an Elvis impersonator marry you and your girlfriend of 3 hours that you just met, you know?
I think that's the only way to marry your girlfriend of 3 hours.
It's true. And it's a worldwide culture. You find Elvis impersonators everywhere. You find them in Russia. You find them in the Philippines. You find them in Samoa. You find them all up and down the Americas.
Yeah, there's nothing else quite like that.
No. It's almost like in the invention of cosplay.
Yeah.
And Elvis had impersonators right from the get-go. His first impersonator was in 1955. That he was a guy that he met, and he was like, oh, he was flattered by it. This person wanted to dress up like him and look like him and sound like
him. Wow.
And his mansion, Graceland, still draws huge crowds and candlelight vigils. And there are people who describe themselves as Presbyterians. And that's people who view Elvis as like a spiritual and sometimes God figure.
Oh my gosh, this comic is just based on Elvis.
It's a huge, and it's funny because he's not really like one of the pop stars that any of the characters in the comic are based off of. But he is really the start of...
Yeah, because like they have Prince in the comic, and they have David Bowie in the comic, and they have Kanye in the comic.
Yeah,
but I feel like none of them as like influential as and iconic as those pop stars are.
None of them. He was the first one, and debatably the biggest. And I thought he was really applicable to this because he's one of the only pop figures to be accused of being both a deity and the devil incarnate, like, at the same time. People were saying that he was Satan and you shouldn't listen to him and you shouldn't follow him. But then, obviously now, there are people who call themselves Presbyterians and that say that he is like a spiritual force for good.
Oh, gosh. Elvis.
So he really helped push that whole idea of, like, the cult of personality, pop star, singer, rock and roll thing. And what he started in the 50s and 60s spread into a bunch of other different personalities in the 70s, late 60s and 70s.
I mean, it also makes sense that no one would be deified like him because at the time he was the only one.
And what's his nickname?
The King?
The King. He's the King, baby. But so yeah, after Elvis, you find all these musicians and rock stars who start to have like such a crucial role in the lives of young people and the public conscious at that time. The front men and women of bands who could seem to spellbind a crowd in the way that Elvis could. And you saw musicians all of a sudden being referred to as guitar gods.
Jimi Hendrix,
you know, Eric Clapton, Jimmy Page. And now, even now, like you see some rappers referred to as rap gods. Yeah. Eminem has a song called Rap God.
Self-crowned rap gods.
It's true. But these stars, they just had this reputation of living fast and loose and nonstop partying lifestyles, which you see a lot in this comic. These pop stars who are the biggest things in the world and they're gods, they have power, but they only have 2 years to live.
Yes, you got to live it up.
So they are living it up. And what made me, what I kind of saw from this is something called the 27 Club. Now, the 27 Club is this informal group of artists, singers, songwriters who all died at the young age of 27.
I'll never make it.
You'll never make it.
I'll never get in.
You're not in the, you can't be in the 27 Club. And the, you know, it's these artists and musicians who really shaped the world and the culture and had these big, huge lifestyles and died young and fast, just like the deities in this comic are destined to do. And there's a lot of names in there. It's a huge list. I'm going to name some because it's a little creepy. Jimi Hendrix is in the 27 Club. Janis Joplin is in the 27 Club. Jim Morrison, who is the lead singer of The Doors, if you don't know who that is. Ron McKernan, who is one of the founding members of the Grateful Dead. Kurt Cobain. And all these people are artists who really defined their era and like were had a huge influence on the kids of their time.
I've been nodding really big this whole time.
Claire's
every
nods.
Name, I'm like, yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Huge.
Yes.
Another one I want to mention is Jeremy Ward. He's from the Mars Volta. I just thrown him in there because that's one of my favorite bands, but they're really not that big. But recently, Amy Winehouse is in the 27 Club
continues.
Yeah. Yeah, it really goes on and on. And I can keep talking about it, but there's so many names on there. I'm just going to link it on the Facebook page. And if you want, you can look it up.
You can have your mind blown there.
Just Google 27 Club. And lastly, one of the last things I want to talk about is YOLO.
Woo!
YOLO is a phrase that the kids are pretty into these days.
YOLO is a little bit old now.
Is it old now?
Yeah, didn't the Drake song come out in 2011?
Yeah, it did, but that's not, like, 5 years? Is that
nah,
that old?
It's yesterday's news. It's yesterday's news.
Well, one of the reasons I wanted to mention it is one of the god pop stars is wearing a shirt with YOLO on it. And this god pop star is Dionysus, off the Greek god of wine and celebration and ecstasy. And I thought it was funny that one of the Greek gods, because the Greek and Roman gods were so synonymous with each other, is the one wearing the YOLO shirt, and YOLO being from an old Latin Roman phrase, carpe diem, that means seize the day. So YOLO, for all you, I don't feel like I should
for
define YOLO.
For all you non-utes.
But it means you only live once, and it's about, you know, enjoying and partying and stuff while you're still alive on this earth. And it's been harkened back to the old Roman phrase, carpe diem, which means seize the day.
So Drake took carpe diem and came out with YOLO instead? Because I know Drake trademarked it.
Drake took carpe diem and came out with YOLO instead, and you're right, he did trademark it.
You can't use it for money unless you pay Drake.
You can still use carpe diem. Horace, I think, owns the trademark carpe diem. Well, that phrase goes back to Horace in 23 BC. He was a great Roman poet. I just thought it was funny that Dionysus, you know, had that YOLO Roman phrase on his shirt, and, you know, Dionysus and Bacchus, the Bacchus being the Roman version. I don't know, I thought it was...
What a
connection.
Nerd.
I want to finish up my segment with a quote from Jim Morrison that I think really describes the pop stars in this comic and just a lot of these pop figures in general who really changed the world. And he said, "I see myself as a huge fiery comet, a shooting star. Everyone stops, points up, and gasps, 'Oh, look at that!' Then whoosh, and I'm gone. And they'll never see anything like it ever again, and they won't ever be able to forget me."
I wish I had that confidence.
Jim Morrison.
He knew.
He was pretty confident. The cojones on that man. So yeah, you know, I wanted to focus on pop star history instead of going into the backstories of 12 obscure deities. I thought that could be kind of dry and boring, but these comics are easily like a wiki rabbit hole.
Yeah, we can post that on the page too.
Yeah. So Claire, what can you tell us about the artist and the writer of The Wicked and the Divine?
Well, they're kind of a team. They've worked on a lot together. I'm going to start with the work that they've done individually, and then I'll get into the teamwork afterwards. So Kieran Gillen was actually a former computer games and music journalist, which makes sense with this subject matter.
Definitely with the music.
As far as other comics he's written for, now he writes comics. He's written for Thor, Uncanny X-Men, Iron Man, Journey into Mystery, The Ludocrats, and he's also the writer for the Star Wars Darth Vader series.
Very cool.
I know. I feel like every kid's dream. Like, I get to write for Darth Vader.
Darth Vader. Oh. Every evil kid's dream, maybe.
I think that's our producer's dream.
Yeah, for sure it is.
Jamie McKelvey has worked with Marvel on The Defenders, X-Men Season 1. And the coolest thing that he did, besides this, obviously, is he actually revamped the character design for Carol Danvers, who is Captain Marvel. And the reason that this was such a big deal at the time is because all of a sudden she was wearing a more practical uniform, not just some, like, skimpy leotard thing.
Yeah, skimpy leotard. That's one. The costumes in this are great.
The art in general. We've talked about it earlier. We keep on mentioning the art is amazing. But also, by making the uniform for Carol Danvers, he subsequently made the character design and uniform for Kamala Khan, who became the new Miss Marvel, who she's the Muslim, I think.
From New Jersey,
from Jersey City, first generation, I believe it's Pakistani, Miss Marvel. And she's one of the most popular characters right now.
Yeah.
Or most, new characters.
Yeah, I've heard the Miss Marvel stuff coming out now.
It's
great.
Oh, I read it. I love it. It's so good. So, Kieran and Jamie, they met at the Bristol Comic Con in 2003. They're both British. At the point, Kieran was the music journalist who was looking to getting into writing comics, and he ended up talking to Jamie, and he kind of showed him some of this work he was working on, and they agreed to work together.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, and they've pretty much been working together ever since. The first thing that they did together was in 2003, and they worked on a comic strip for PlayStation Magazine UK called Save Point. And then
sounds funny.
And then the next thing they worked on, this is what Kieran showed him at Comic-Con. It's called Phonogram, and it's like their first real comic. But it basically follows a certain sect of people in England that call themselves phonomancers, and they channel their magical powers through their music.
Through people enjoying their music. Right? Yeah. I've heard of this. It's supposed to be pretty cool.
Yeah, you're sensing a theme here, though, right?
Yeah, it's true.
They also did the revamp of the Young Avengers for Marvel, which was very critically acclaimed. It actually won the 2014 GLAAD Award for media, and that's basically for portraying gay characters in a positive light. And the GLAAD Award is Gay and Lesbian Alliance Against Defamation.
Oh, very cool. One of our friends was big into the Young Avengers, right? Did Aaron have it or something?
I think you're talking about the Teen Titans.
Maybe that's Young Avengers, Teen Titans, whatever.
Same thing. But they do this thing where they tend to really explore the youth and growing up and, you know, these big
channeling
forces around
them. Channeling the teen angst.
Yeah, they do that very well. Yeah. So as far as this particular comic goes, Kieran said that the idea came to him right after his father was diagnosed with a terminal illness. I'm pretty sure it was cancer. And this is basically his response to mortality. The quote I have is that life is really, really short. What are you going to do with it? Why the hell be an artist? Of course, an artist would ask that question. So he kind of wrote this about the creators of art facing their own mortality.
Yeah.
He believes that musicians and pop stars are also the closest thing that we have to superheroes.
Which is very true. I mean, it's hard to argue against Beyoncé not being some kind of superhero right now.
Yeah, now that I think of Beyoncé in that context,
if someone was a superhero in our day and age, you'd say, like, Beyoncé.
Taylor Swift.
Taylor Swift is like
Katy Perry.
Katy Perry, even.
Yeah. And they believe that fandom is a very powerful thing And that art can bring clarity and courage to someone's life.
Yeah, just go to a convention, man. There's a lot of like people who are mostly very timid, but all of a sudden they get to dress up as their favorite whatever, and they're just out and about, and they feel so much more.
And I believe that, but I also feel like as the artist being like, oh yes, we are bringing clarity to the fans.
You think it's a little too arty, Claire?
I feel
sensitive
like,
artist.
No, I think it's the egotistical. Yeah. I mean, and I don't think they're thinking about themselves as much as they're thinking of pop stars.
Yeah.
And I agree with a lot of it. They wrote, so about how they formatted this comic, because I think this is really cool and interesting. Basically, they wanted to make it like a pop record, and they designed it to be reread. And they wanted it to be like a pop song in that it has a really light touch, but really heavy content.
Yeah.
Not all pop songs have light touch, heavy content. I think a lot of pop songs are very light content.
Are pretty bubblegummy.
Right, but you can see that with the comic, pop songs, how some of them can actually explore really intense things.
Yeah, yeah.
But be really fun to listen to.
Yeah, and these single issues are extremely catchy, I think is a really good way to describe them.
Yeah, and also, they think that both comics and pop songs are very short form statements, and you're trying to get every single idea you have into these short little pieces of art, basically.
Creativity with limitations. We talk about that a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, in the back of the third trade volume of this comic, they have little short one-page stories. There's like four of them, I think. And they're really good. You know, it's just one page, one character, and then you move on. It's a different one.
So I've only gotten through the first two trades.
Disclaimer.
So I haven't seen that yet.
They're pretty cool.
I'm excited. And they think that both comics and pop songs are hard to take seriously, but they think that someone could buy into it and then start to explore each format more deeply.
Yeah.
Which is what they hope they can, that's like the end goal for this comic.
Yeah, I definitely feel that in this comic. Like when we get to opinions, it's something I want to talk about is... how deeply I think you could dive into the social commentary here.
Right, and then maybe want to explore other comics if you hadn't read comics before.
Yeah.
Now, this comic has been highly praised for its diversity. The main character is a bisexual, mixed-race London teen.
Bisexual, biracial, just like we like them.
Yes. In 2016, the comic was nominated for a media award for GLAAD. Just like the one they won for the Young Avengers.
Yeah.
And when the creators are asked how they feel about getting all this praise for it, they say that they actually feel like they're just writing a comic about the people that they see. They both live in London, and they're trying to pick people that they see on the bus and write a comic about those teenagers.
Yeah. One of the main characters is trans in it as well.
Yeah, but it's not a big deal.
But it's not,
just there.
She's just
one
of the characters.
I do feel is the best way to approach that.
Yeah, yeah.
And they say that comics should reflect the pop culture of the times.
Yeah.
That's how they feel about comics. But and this is something I found really interesting. So a lot of the superheroes, the biggest like characters in comics, were created by white men in the 40s and the 60s. And that is a hard thing to break away from. Like no matter what, those are these characters.
Yeah.
So it's hard for them to reflect the times because they're still stuck in that early rut.
It's hard for them to tell the stories of right now.
Exactly.
Of kids going through like, you know, dealing with sexuality or dealing with race or dealing with, you know,
because they were not things that were being addressed in the 40s and 60s. So they feel that the comics that are being written now, well, in the comics that they're trying to write, they're trying to just make it a comic of the time.
And I think they do a good job at that.
Yeah. I mean, we live in New York City, and these characters could certainly be in New York City.
Definitely.
Kieran also says that this comic is him and Jamie McKelvey and the Matt Wilson, the colorist. They're kind of they three of them have been working together for a while, and that they are finishing off this present stage in their creative career, and they're hoping that this is such an artist. I always like, I'm like, oh, this artist thing, but they're building upon everything that they've done before, and they're hoping that. When he's done with this, he'll know what direction he wants to go on from here.
Oh, what the next project will be.
Right. And I should also mention the colorist because they were also talking about how in comics, they feel like in the 90s in comics, there was this huge focus on just the writer. Like for instance, Neil Gaiman writes Sandman.
Yeah.
And how, especially as comics have gone on, now it's more of a collaborative effort, but for whatever reason, the writer still gets most of the credit. So he was, Kieran was very big on giving credit to Jamie McKelvey, who's the illustrator who we talked about earlier, but also Matt Wilson, who is the colorist for this, who they have worked with many times before. And I think he makes the comic.
Yeah, I think it's a good story, you know, but it wouldn't be, this comic wouldn't be what it is without the artwork, because the artwork is mind-blowingly good.
It's so good. As far as the future for this series, in 2015 in June, it was announced that it was optioned as a possible TV series by Universal Television. So they're affiliated with NBC, Sci-Fi, USA, and Hulu. So it could be coming to a TV show. It could be a TV show coming to you,
yeah,
I should say. This comic has been very popular, especially for an independent comic. It's gotten high critical praise. The first issue sold out when it hit the stands.
Really?
Yeah, and it's continued to sell really well. I know in 2015, the first volume had sold 245,000 copies.
That's pretty damn good.
And we didn't mention this before, but this is by Image Comics, so it's not DC or Marvel.
It's an independent, yeah, sort of like creator-controlled,
mm-hmm,
comics. And they're actually, I was listening to a comics podcast talking about how you shouldn't talk about the big two in comics, Marvel and DC, anymore. They said you should talk about the big three.
What podcast is this?
Because Image is doing really well. The Comics Plopcast.
Mm-hmm. For those who are interested.
Yeah, it's very good.
So this kind of leads me to, what do you think, Kyle?
I really enjoyed the stories. I thought it's a really great original idea. It was maybe, and this is something you mentioned to me, maybe aimed towards someone younger than us.
Yeah.
But the idea was so original. The art was so beautiful. And I really liked a lot of the characters. I thought it was a lot of fun.
Yeah. I think that it's geared towards younger audiences. We were talking about the whole, like, Holden Caulfield, Catcher in the Rye thing.
Yeah.
Where, like, I just don't relate so much to the choices the main character is making. But I think that's because she's a teen. And I'm like, yeah, why are you being so stupid?
She's a 17-year-old girl. And she does feel, you know, the angst of, like, growing up and idolizing these pop stars and what that kind of means and what that kind of does to you.
Right. But I do think they write really well. I think they write teens well. And I think they write in a way that I think that teens would enjoy this comic.
I think so too. Yeah, teens, early 20s. And I mean, even I'm 27. I really enjoy this comic and I'm going to keep reading.
Oh, you have a year to die.
I know. If I die in this 1 year, guys, I can be in the club. And we don't want that though. I know some clubs are pretty exclusive and you want to get in, but that's not one you want to be a part of. One thing that I really, really like about this comic and wish we could go even more in depth into is just the social commentary on what it means to be a pop idol right now. And granted, these two writers are by no means pop idols, so like how accurately are they portraying this? I don't know, but it seemed very genuine and very accurate to me.
Because you're a pop idol.
Because I'm a pop idol, yes, and I feel the pain that they're trying to write. No, one of the issues, it's issue 13, and it's kind of a self-contained issue. It's all about the goddess Tara.
Yeah, and she's kind of a Katy Perry
kind
type
of a Katy Perry
reincarnation. That's what I saw her compared to.
Yeah, she's very hated. Throughout the you really only see her in that issue 13. Before that, you only hear about her, and it's a lot of hateful things. It's like, Tara sucks, you know, or like, Tara's the worst. And you read that issue and you find out why, and it's a self-contained issue. And if you're curious about the comic, I recommend you can start with just that, because it doesn't give away anything of the overarching plot, or not much anyway. And it's just a really, really good, I think, commentary on what it means to be a public figure and to everyone has access to you. Everyone can tweet to you and you can read all these hateful, nasty things that anyone has about, like, thinks about you.
Yeah, I think anyone who's, you know, a bit of a presence, a bit of a public presence gets that.
Yeah.
It's like the beauty and the horror of the internet.
Yeah. Is that, and you can say like, oh, they should grow a thick skin because they have so much money. Like, who cares? But then when you do try and grow that thick skin and like flaunt, like, I don't care what they say about me, I'm so rich, people hate you for that too.
Yeah. So it's a no-win situation.
Yeah. And no matter how much money you have, it still sucks to have people every day be like, you're a slut. You suck. You're terrible. Your art is crap. I'm going to murder you.
Yeah. Ask, wait, who created No Man's Sky again? We just talked about it.
Oh, Sean Murray. Yes. And we're laughing, but it is sad. It's it sucks,
death threats,
man.
For, like,
it's not cool.
Not cool. We were talking earlier about the art. There is this particular scene in the second volume where they create a rave. And this is the best, like, visual representation of a rave that I think I've ever seen. It is so cool and just so well done. And, like, the colorist, Matt Wilson, just what he does with the pages is just amazing. You just feel that. I felt like I was in a rave and I was reading this on the subway. Granted, the subway can kind of seem like a rave sometimes.
Yeah, sometimes it feels like sweaty bodies, smelly. It's less fun, though.
Not the music. The music sometimes is good. Depends who's music you're listening to on their headphones next to you.
It's true. But yeah, no, I agree. That was a really well illustrated and written scene. I really liked that. Like I said, issue 13, if you want to check out this comic, I think is a good place to just read that issue. And then if you like it, start from the beginning. And Claire, who's your favorite god in the series, do you think? Do you have one?
I feel like I didn't get to know some of them as well as I wanted to. Or like I'm going to get to know them better, maybe.
Better, yeah, later.
I did like Lucifer. Because I think she was the first, and the gender, there's gender bending. So like Lucifer is modeled after David Bowie. But she's a girl.
Yeah.
A bisexual girl.
Modeled after the Thin White Duke era of David Bowie, which is, I think, kind of late 70s, early 80s.
Yeah. 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 She has that vibe.
Yeah.
But she's the first god that you really get to know. Mm-hmm. And I feel like I still haven't quite gotten to know another god as well as her.
She's like the kid on the playground in eighth grade who's like trying to give you cigarettes.
Yeah, and you want to be as cool as them.
And you want to be as cool as she is.
Yeah. Who's your favorite god?
I really like Morrigan. I think she's pretty awesome. She's like the gothic Celtic goddess of like war, and she lives in the subway where it's dark and stuff.
She's got her crows going.
And she's got has these crow powers, and she's actually three gods in one. But she's also I don't know who she's based off of though, honestly. Maybe like an Amy Winehouse thing, but I'm not quite sure.
Oh, yeah, I'm not sure. But that's one of those gods where I do really like her, but I feel like I need to get to know her a little bit better.
And then Ball also is pretty cool.
Ball's so cool.
Who's based off of Kanye. And Ball was like this Phoenician deity, and there's been a bunch of different interpretations of him. But
yeah, he's really cool. I almost said Ball when you asked who my favorite was.
Yeah, he's pretty awesome. And I just want to also bring attention to the fact that Woden is based off of Daft Punk. He's wearing like a Daft Punk mask, and he's in like the what's that racing?
Oh, I don't know.
What's that movie with the Tron? He's in like the Tron suit.
He is. It's cool though. It's really cool.
Yeah, I think
this comic is so cool.
It's very cool. It's such a cool, neat. I mean, we say cool. It's such a great original idea. And even if the writing is sometimes eclipsed by how great the art is, it's still good writing.
It is. It is. Yeah, I do prefer the art to the writing, but it doesn't matter. Like, I'm really happy to be in this world.
If you're really hungry for an original story, definitely check it out, The Wicked and the Divine. Thank you all so much for listening. Once again, I'm Kyle Willoughby.
And I'm Claire White.
And we are Dragons, Sexy Robots, and Adventures, A Nerd Manual. Feel free to contact us on our website at dsrapodcast.com. We would hold strong, positive feelings for you if you could rate and review us on iTunes. Strong, strongly positive. Mm-hmm. And you can find the show on Twitter at DSRA Podcast. I can be found on Twitter at Klex303. That's KLEX303.
I can be found at Along with Claire. That's CLAIRE.
And you can find our producer James at James Foey Jr. That's James Foey, FOUHEYJR on Twitter. You can learn more about The Wicked and the Divine and some of our show notes, including Elvis Colts and the 27 Club.
And I was actually going to post a playlist that he made to go along with the comic.
That is very cool.
Super cool. Yeah. The Spotify list.
And you can find all that on our Facebook page at DSRA Podcast. Our producer, who would be the god of not constructive, but just critical criticism, is James Foey. Our logo was done by Patty Hyland, the goddess of art and dragons. And Sexy Robots. And our theme was composed by the decadent Pete Rowan, the god of all things music, specifically U2, The Who, and The Beatles. Once again, this is Dragons, Sexy Robots, and Adventures, A Nerd Manual. Thanks for listening, and we will see you next week.